greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on energy when we come back. The lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. If you can learn this one rule, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever, so don't give the prosecutor his victory. At least make him work for it. Now, listen to what the courts have to say about this thing of keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, or in some cases, police intimidation. One judge in U.S. versus Dickerson put it this way. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That's cited in U.S. versus Dickerson. A second judge in Belknap versus United States put it this way. He said, "You can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." And that comes from Belknap versus United States. Now, this constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted, says Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. All right, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, energy. We're talking about petroleum, nuclear power, wind power, solar power, hydropower, biofuel, wave power, tidal power, coal, biomass, and geothermal. Boy, there's a lot of different sources of energy that are used on planet Earth to power our computers, our electric lights, power our automobiles, our airplanes. There's a lot of these sources that of and by themselves could furnish all of the energy needs for all of mankind forever. Well, not exactly forever, because all of this energy comes from the sun, and the sun is going to burn out in 100,000 years, according to the latest estimates that I've seen. 100,000 years, and that's because the sun is burning up at the rate of 5 feet an hour. We didn't know that when I was a kid, and we thought that the sun had been burning for billions and billions of years. And then they got to watching the sun, calculating and doing their homework, and they found out that no, the sun is actually burning up. It's actually getting smaller by about 5 feet every hour. That's about 120 feet a day, times 365 days in the year. So even our sun is burning up. But for practical purposes, you know, for people like you and I, we're mortal human beings, and we're going to live for about 70 years. If you look into the future, you know, for another 1,000 years, there isn't any problem with petroleum, coal. There's plenty of both. Natural gas, lots of it. Geothermal energy, yep, it's going to be here for the next 1,000 years. So when Jesus comes back for that 1,000-year reign during the millennium, that millennial reign, there's going to be plenty of energy for everybody. Sit back and relax. Take in the slack. But Richard Nemelia, or Nemela, is spelled N-I-E-M-E-L-A, if you want a copy of his material. He puts out a newsletter every day, Richard Nemela. And he put one out here on oil shortage blame. He said, here finally are some facts related to the current contrived oil shortage. There ain't one. Alaska has several areas that hold massive amounts and are not being pumped, despite the facts that show that enough oil sits in the Gull Island site for the entire United States for the next 200 years. Similar large new finds are also known to exist off the southwest tip of Florida, in the Four Corners area, and in the Dakotas, all kept quiet and cloaked so that the Rockefellers and Rothschilds can profit from a contrived shortage that raises the price of oil. It is the method that the One World crowd is using to intimidate Americans into compliance with their plans. Well, I suspect that the wrath of some Americans will become so roused that these intimidators will be replaced. I don't think that's true. It hasn't been true over the past 200 years. It isn't true today, and I doubt that it's going to be in the future, but we all have high hopes that maybe reason, logic, and common sense will come back. It won't, it hasn't, and it's not very likely to in the near future. Now, who's really to blame for this $110 a barrel oil? Well, Investor's Business Daily points out that Energy, a refinery, burns in Texas while politicians fiddle in Washington. As oil goes over $110 a barrel, we don't have to worry about Hugo Chavez restricting supply. He's the president of Venezuela. We have the Congress to do that. Suppose you had a ton of money sitting in your bank account, but you decided to max out your credit cards first. Well, that's the energy policy of the United States as fashioned by our Congress. At these prices, we have $1 trillion worth of oil sitting under a section of frozen tundra the size of Dulles Airport near Washington, D.C. We can get to it, but instead we prefer to shovel billions of our dollars to thugs like Chavez, while the same politicians who lock up our domestic energy praise him when he offers cheap home heating oil to states in the Northeast. Chavez has said that he's changed his mind about cutting off supplies to the United States, but it's because he'd have a hard time selling Venezuela's heavy crude, which requires special refining. Now, he's not doing us any favors. Unfortunately, neither is our United States Congress. Oil futures closed above $100 for the first time after the February 18th explosion of the Alton USA refinery in Big Springs, Texas. It could be closed down for 2 months. Yet the NIMBYs, NIMBYs, those are the not in my backyard people, will not let new refineries be built here in the United States, and the greenies won't let the domestic oil be refined. The heads in the tundra crowd is led by Hillary Clinton. She has voted no fewer than 9 times to block drilling in a tiny frozen part of the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. Her husband, Bill Clinton, first blocked the Anwar development in 1995. After Hurricane Katrina disabled offshore oil platforms, revealing our energy vulnerability, Mrs. Clinton said it makes no sense to respond to a disaster in the Gulf of Mexico by making a disaster in Alaska. Never mind that the caribou and other critters have thrived despite drilling in Prudhoe Bay, which recently delivered its 15 billionth barrel of oil through the Alaska pipeline. Oil from Anwar could meet all of the New York petroleum needs for 34 years, and yet that state's junior senator opposes getting at it. Anwar could supply every drop of petroleum for Florida for 29 years, said former Interior Secretary Gail Norton. New York for 34 years, California for 16 years, New Hampshire for 315 years. It could also supply Washington, D.C., a place where there's no shortage of hot air, for 1,710 years. In 2005, the Senate voted twice by narrow margins on amendments authorizing Anwar drilling to a budget resolution bill and a budget reconciliation bill. 41 Democrats voted against both. 23 of them were found to have voted against Anwar in 1995. Barack Obama, who has voted twice against drilling in Anwar, has noted that a large portion of the $800 million that we spend on foreign oil every day goes to some of the world's most volatile regimes. And still he says that we cannot drill our way out of the problem. Call this the audacity of helplessness. In his book, The Audacity of Hope, Obama writes, instead of subsidizing the oil industry, we should end every single tax break the industry currently receives and demand that 1% of the revenues from oil companies with over $1 billion in quarterly profits go toward financing alternative energy research and infrastructure. Yet he would subsidize the ethanol industry, which contributes to rising food prices and hurts the environment through increased agricultural runoff. He would feed the world, but he would have us put cars or ears of corn in our cars. And we're not against alternative energy. America is going to need all of the energy that it can produce from all sources. We just don't like leaving energy in the ground. The Democrats promise hope and change. Let's hope that we develop our domestic energy sources, starting with Anwar. Now, that would be a real change. For politically incorrect news ignored by the American news media, send your friends email addresses for real news from thenewsman@ij.net. That's called real news over the internet. Richard Namila. Well, there's a little bit more to the story than Richard points out, but the point that he's making, I think, is well taken. There's no energy shortage here in the United States. It isn't because we're lacking in coal or oil. It's that the powers that be want to keep coal and oil as the primary sources of fuel. And that's because the people that own it have lots of money, and they can buy the Congress, and they have. And they can buy Hillary Clinton, and they did. And they can buy Barack Obama, and they have. It's just that simple. You are not going to have any official change in the use of petroleum or coal in your lifetime under this governmental regime. It is not going to happen in the United States of America. Now, the coal and the oil interests control both sides of the issue. Number one, they're pictured, and they picture themselves as the robber barons that need to be reined in. They created the environmental movement, and the environmental movement is the check and balance on the raiders or the robber barons. I pointed this out before. Let me do it again. Atlantic Richfield, the oil company, is the biggest single contributor to the Sierra Club. The Greenies and all of these environmental groups are financed by the energy companies. They are promoted. They are financed by. They are the lapdogs of the energy industry. And it makes all the sense in the world. It's a marketing strategy. It's for the purposes of selling coal and oil. It's not good for our economy, it's not good for you and me, it's not good for our nation, but it's really good for ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal. And after all, they're the people with the money. Now, let's take a look at coal, because coal is the single biggest energy source in the world. It produces 53% of the electricity here in the United States. In fact, coal is a fossil fuel formed in swamp ecosystems where plant remains were saved by water and mud from oxidation and biodegradation. Coal is readily combustible. It's black or brownish black rock. It's a sedimentary rock. But the harder forms, such as anthracite coal, can be regarded as metamorphic rocks because of later exposure to elevated temperature and pressure. It's composed primarily of carbon along with assorted other elements, including sulfur. It's the largest single source of fuel for the generation of electricity worldwide, as well as the largest worldwide source of carbon dioxide emissions, slightly ahead of petroleum, and about double that of natural gas. Coal is extracted from the ground by coal mining, either underground mining or open pit mining, called surface mining. As geological processes apply pressure to dead matter over time, under suitable conditions, it is transformed successively into peat, considered to be a precursor of coal. It has industrial importance as a fuel in some countries, for example, Ireland and Finland. It then turns to lignite, also referred to as brown coal, is the lowest rank of coal and used almost exclusively as fuel for steam electric power generations. Jet is a compact form of lignite that is sometimes polished and has been used as an ornamental stone since ancient times. Sub-bituminous coal, whose properties range from those of lignite to those of bituminous coal, and are used primarily as fuel for steam electric power generation. Bituminous coal is a dense coal, usually black, sometimes dark brown, often with well-defined bands of bright and dull material, used primarily as fuel in steam electric power generation, with substantial quantities also used for heat and power applications in manufacturing and to make coke for steel making. Anthracite, the highest rank, a harder, glossy black coal used primarily for residential and commercial space heating. Graphite, technically the highest rank, but difficult to ignite, and is not so commonly used as fuel. It's mostly used in pencils, and when powdered, it's used as a lubricant. The classification of coal is generally based on the content of volatiles. However, the exact classification varies between countries. According to the German classification, coal is classified as follows. And I have a table here that shows you how to classify it. The middle six grades in the table represent a progressive transition from the English language subbituminous to bituminous coal. Now, coal has been used for thousands of years. And a 120,000-year-old Stone Age coal stone hunting camp was discovered in 2005 by archaeologists in an open-cast coal stone mine in Germany, its first known use being campfire cooking fuel for German hunters. China Coal Information Institute reports the Chinese mined coal stone for fuel 10,000 years ago, at the time of the New Stone Age or Neolithic era. People in Shaanxi, now the largest coal production base, have been burning coal as fuel since that time. Outcrop coal was used in Britain during the Bronze Age, 2 to 3,000 years BC, where it was or has been detected as forming part of the composition of funeral pyres. It was also commonly used in the early period of the Roman occupation. Evidence of trade in coal dated to about AD 200 has been found at the inland port of Heronbridge near Chester and in the Furlands of East Anglia, where coal from the Midlands was transported by way of car dyke for use in drying grain. Coal cinders have been found in the hearths of villas and military forts, particularly in Northumberland, dated to around AD 400. In the west of England, contemporary writers describe the wonder of a permanent brazier of coal on the altar of Minerva, that's a modern-day Bath, although in fact easily accessible surface coal from what is now the Somerset coalfield was in common use in quite lowly dwellings locally. However, there's no evidence that the product was of any great importance in Britain before the High Middle Ages, after about 1000 AD. Mineral coal came to be referred to as sea coal, probably, because it came to many places in eastern England, including London, by sea. As a fuel, coal is primarily used as a solid fuel to produce electricity and heat through combustion. World coal consumption is about 6.2 billion tons per year, of which about 75% is used for the production of electricity. China produced 2.38 billion tons in 2006. India produced 447 million tons in 2006. 83% of China's electricity comes from coal. The United States consumes about 1,000 billion tons of coal each year, using 90% of it for generation of electricity. The world in total produces about 6.19 billion tons of coal in 2006. When coal is used for electrical generation, it is usually pulverized and then burned in a furnace with a boiler. The furnace heat converts boiler water to steam, which is then used to spin turbines, which turn generators and create electricity. The thermodynamic efficiency of this process has been improved over time. Standard steam turbines have topped out with some of the most advanced, reaching about 35% of thermodynamic efficiency for the entire process, which means 65% of the coal energy is rejected as waste heat into the surrounding environment. Old coal power plants, especially grandfathered-in power plants, are significantly less efficient, and they reject higher levels of waste heat. The emergence of the supercritical turbine concept envisions running a boiler at extremely high temperatures and high pressures, with projected efficiencies of 46%, with further theorized increases in temperature and pressure perhaps resulting in even higher efficiencies. Other efficient ways to use coal are combined cycle power plants, combined heat and power cogeneration, and the MHD topping cycle. Approximately 40% of the world electricity production uses coal. The total known deposits recoverable by current technologies, including highly polluting, low energy content types of coal, such as lignite, bituminous, and so on, might be sufficient for another 300 years at the current use of consumption levels, although maximal production could be reached within decades. See world coal reserves below. Now, in this article, it comes from Wikipedia. If you'd like to get it, just go online to the Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. It's called en.wikipedia, spelled wikipedia.org. Now, this coal is also used for coke, for the making of steel. Coke is a solid carbon residue derived from low ash, low sulfur, bituminous coal, from which the volatile constituents are driven off by baking it in an oven without oxygen at temperatures as high as 1,000 degrees centigrade, so that the fixed carbon and residual ash are fused together. Metallurgic coke is used as a fuel and as a reducing agent in smelting iron ore in a blast furnace. Coke from coal is gray, hard, and porous, and has a heating value of about 24.8 million BTUs per ton. Byproducts of this conversion of coal to coke include coal tar, ammonia, light oils, and coal gas. Petroleum coke is the solid residue obtained in oil refining, which resembles coke but contains too many impurities to be useful in the metallurgical applications. Now, there's also a process called liquefaction and gasification that we use in coal. I want you to notice here that coal was produced by being laid down in seams in water. Coal is a fossil fuel formed in swamp ecosystems where plant remains were saved by water and mud from oxidation. That was Noah's flood produced the coal seams that you see today. The world was covered by vegetation. The vegetation was uprooted. It was sorted by water. And it was put into huge amounts. And it was deposited by flood action under mud and sediments. And the pressure and the lack of oxygen turns it into coal. Now, coal can be produced in the laboratory in about 21 days. So the idea that coal takes billions of years, as Carl Sagan used to say, is false. We now know that coal can be produced in the laboratory in 21 days and was produced in the last 4,000 years. Now, the biggest supply of coal in the United States is located in Wyoming. It's called the Powder River Basin, and I forgot the exact size of this basin off the top of my head, but it's thousands of square miles. As I recall, it's something like 400 miles long, and it has coal seams that are 200 feet thick. There may be some seams even thicker than that, but 200 foot thick seams of coal. And it's mined by heavy machinery. In fact, the dump trucks that they use to haul it are three stories high. The operators of these trucks climb into them like locomotives. In fact, they're bigger than railroad locomotives. And I've forgotten how much they haul now, but it's a giant volume, and they use huge shovels to dig this stuff out. And they put it into captive coal trains. Now, the Union Pacific Railroad has a line from Omaha up to Cheyenne, Wyoming, four tracks wide along Highway 30. Four tracks wide. And while driving across Nebraska one day, I happened to get off the freeway and I went over to Highway 30, the old route. And I was driving along there, and I saw these coal trains, so I stopped at a railroad crossing and spread out a little array there for a picnic, and I started counting the coal trains, and here's what I observed. A coal train has 109 cars, although on other occasions I've counted as many as 127 cars. These are called captive trains. And three locomotives are pulling them. Now, remember, coming from Wyoming east, the grade is downhill. So they have three locomotives. And there's four tracks wide. And three tracks are used for coal traveling eastbound, one train every 15 minutes. Three tracks wide, four trains per hour. That's 12 trains per hour of 109 cars each headed eastbound. I watched it for about 2 or 3 hours. Now, I would presume, this is during the daytime, I would presume that at night, these same captive coal trains are proceeding from the east to the west. You know, all of those coal cars have to get back to Wyoming somehow. One track was used for Amtrak and regular freight, you know, the regular freight trains. They were traveling in both directions on one track. I assume that they go down the track, pull into a siding, and then the train goes by. Now, that's a lot of coal, and that's just coming out of Wyoming. There are other coal-producing regions of the country, down in the south and in the east in the Appalachians, Kentucky. You know, their national rock or stone is coal. And they produce a lot of it in the east, and most of the coal in this country is used for electricity. And it's a big heating source. Now, you can sit back and relax because here in the United States, we have a 666-year supply of coal. Now, worldwide, there's only a 300-year supply of coal. But here in the United States, we have a, God has blessed us with coal. We have quite a bit of a 600-year supply. So there's plenty of coal. In fact, we could power, well, after the break here, we'll get back to gasification. We could use coal in this country to make ourselves energy independent. We could make all of our diesel and gasoline out of coal. It was a process pioneered by the Germans. It was discovered back in World War I, but they used it in Germany during World War II. And it's used in South Africa today. It's a little more expensive, but it's, you know, instead of paying $100 a barrel for that cheap oil that costs nothing to produce, for around $70 a barrel, we could produce it out of our own coal, employ Americans in the process, tell the Arabs to go to hell in the handbasket, and to be energy independent. Now, we haven't, we aren't, and we won't. And that's because the powers that be want the status quo the way it is. And it's a very well-ordered status quo. On the one side, you've got the environmentalists, and on the other side, you've got the robber barons. The robber barons finance both sides. And while all of this controversy is going on and all this talk about energy independence and about our energy needs, all this talk been going on all of my life, and peak oil, and higher prices, and $100 oil. All of that is just diatribe for public consumption. Nothing more, nothing less. All right, I got to give you a reminder here at the midway point that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate, and they're correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about energy and energy policy here in the United States. Of course, it also works worldwide because the powers that be, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers who control between those two banking families, they control most of the energy on planet Earth. There's a lot of minor players that go along with it, but these people have an agenda. They have a goal. They have a lot of money. And they create the policy. They create what you believe. So, you know, if you're an environmentalist and you're a greenie and you're voting for Ralph Nader, God bless you, and I'm sure you're sincere and you mean well. But bear in mind that there are certain facts out there that you should put into your computer. And one of the facts that we need to put into our computer is that there's no shortage of oil. And the people that control, that own the oil or control the oil, want to market that oil and maximize their profits. They do not want to produce oil at $10 a barrel, make a dollar profit when they can produce oil for $100 a barrel and make $90 profit. So, and I don't blame them. I mean, I'm a businessman too. And if you're a businessman, you can understand the profit motive. Now, the reason that we're at this crossroads in history is because about 50 years ago or so, we made a very dramatic change in our energy policy. We used to have an energy policy driven by the Ten Commandments from the bottom up, where thousands of people owned the oil. That policy was changed in the 1950s and 60s through environmental legislation. And so now we don't have thousands or tens of thousands of little people at the bottom who own all the oil. It's five major oil companies through two banking dynasties who own all of the oil. So we have top-down energy policy, and that policy is created by the government in Washington, D.C., and that government is controlled by these banking families. And so as a result of that, you have $100 a barrel oil instead of $10 a barrel oil. And that's just the reality of it. I don't know if that's good or bad or right or wrong. It's just a report. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. Is it going to change anytime soon? Not that I can tell. Now, I suspect that when the Messiah returns, the second coming occurs, and we get into the millennium, we're going to go back to the Ten Commandments. And we're going to abandon the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. But for the time being, for the present, for where we are today on the chessboard, we are practicing the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's our official public policy. And as long as we practice communism, we will stand in line and share the shortage. That's what communism promises. That's what communism delivers. Now, from the scripture, under the Ten Commandments, the heritage of our father Jacob provides an abundance. And we don't stand in line, and we have an abundance for each and every family, using the family unit. All right, now let me give you a couple of more facts and figures here concerning coal. There's a process here called gasification. High prices of oil and natural gas are leading to increased interest in the BTU conversion. These technologies such as gasification, methanation, and liquefaction. Coal gasification breaks down the coal into its components, usually by subjecting it to high temperatures and pressure, using steam and measured amounts of oxygen. This leads to the production of syngas, a mixture containing mainly consisting of carbon monoxide, CO, and hydrogen, H2. In the past, coal was converted to make coal gas, which was piped to customers to burn for illumination. They used it for heating and cooking and lights. At present, the safer natural gas is used instead. South Africa still uses gasification of coal for much of its petrochemical needs. The Synthetic Fuels Corporation was a U.S. government-funded corporation established in 1980 to create a market for alternatives to imported fossil fuels such as coal gasification. The corporation was discontinued in 1985. Let me pause right here and make an editorial comment. Back around the turn of the century, before oil was commonly used, we had to have a modality for running all of those gas lamps out on the streets, and so they gasified coal. It's a technology that's been around for a long time. They use it in South Africa because there was an embargo placed upon South Africa years ago because of their apartheid policies. And so the world's governments and the United Nations put an embargo upon the white government of South Africa, so they responded just like the Germans did when they were cut off from petroleum supplies in World War II. They made their gasoline out of coal. Now, with oil at $100 a barrel, boys and girls, or $70 a barrel, we could economically use the coal that we have here in the United States and do the same thing that the South Africans and the Germans did, and the South Africans are doing. And we can do it for less than the $100. We're not going to, as I pointed out. The government, and don't think for a moment that by electing Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton now that you're going to change any policies in Washington. That's not going to happen. Republicans and Democrats are both controlled by the same banking families, same banking cartels. So that isn't an option. That isn't going to happen. You're going to have a status quo, and you're going to have more of the same. Now, you need to plan your strategy around that. No, I'm not here telling you, you need to vote for this or that guy so that we can change these policies. You and I are not going to change jack diddly squat. We're going to live with it. You're going to live with $6 a gallon gasoline here very shortly, within the next 2 or 3 years. And that's going to sink this economy here in the United States to the level of 1934, 35, and 36. We've been through this before, and we're going to go through it again. Now, there will be survivors and there will be victims, just like there was on the Titanic. There were survivors and there were victims. And I want to be one of those survivors. Now, during these depressions, there are fortunes made. And I had a guy in my class here the other day. He came in from Arizona, and I was talking to him and his wife, and I pointed out to him. He's in the process of moving from the city up into the country. He bought 250 acres of ground or so. And he's making the transition from the city to his survival retreat up in the countryside there. And we were chit-chatting a little bit. And I pointed out to him, I said, opportunity is like rain. It's everywhere. Now, most people cannot recognize opportunity. And most people are introverts rather than extroverts. Only 5% of us are extroverts. 95% of us are introverts. 95% of us are followers and 5% of us are leaders. Now, your job is to move yourself from that introvert group over to the leader group so that you can profit from this coming Great Depression. Rather than fear the depression or the collapse of the economy, why don't you look at it in a positive light? What businesses do well in depressed times? Now, this man has a house, and he's going to lose his house. Okay, so you get foreclosed on. That's not the end of the world. Foreclosures have been going on for thousands of years, boys and girls. You're not the first person to be foreclosed on, and you're not going to be the last. It's a bad break. It's too bad. When I'm playing chess with my daughter and she takes my queen, it's a bad break. It's a disability. But the game isn't over just because you lose your queen. And the game isn't over just because the economy slides into recession or slides into depression. Now, if you're out here in a boutique and you're selling expensive soap and flowers and trash and nonsense, well, then that's a problem to you because those are the things that sell when people have lots of money. When people don't have very much money, they're still out buying, selling, and trading. It's like they always have. They're just not buying, selling, and trading the same things. So what we need to do is to gear ourselves to buying, selling, and trading these things in depression, in depressed times, that people want to buy. The bad news back in the Depression years of the 1930s was that the unemployment rate was 25%. The good news was that the employment rate was 75%. And we want to sell to those 75% that are employed making money. And the 25% that are unemployed and not making money do not make a good market. They don't have any money. It's just that simple. You don't have to be, you know, a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. Now, going back here to gasification, the Synthetic Fuels Corporation in the United States was established in 1980. Remember I said they got this, the politicians, you know, they get out here and they pass laws and they jump up and down and they hoop and holler about energy independence. And then 5 years later, it was discontinued in 1985. Why? Hell, we don't want synthetic gas made from coal. It's too cheap. And we've got all this natural gas that comes out of the oil wells, out of the ground. And we want to sell that first. It's called liquefied petroleum, LP gas. Now, over in the Middle East, they got all this LP gas, and they're building some big terminals down in Baja, California. And they're liquefying this gas, and they want to sell it to us. Well, it's good business, and I don't deny that, and it makes good sense. I think that we should conserve energy around the world, and that we should use that energy wisely. And then when God comes back and takes over, we're going to do just that. But we're going to use an inefficient system of bottom-up Ten Commandment program instead of top-down Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto, a system in our economy. Now, when we use the marketplace to determine prices, and when we have wealth divided among many people at the bottom, we find that more people benefit. More people. You have millions of people that benefit. The reason you have so much poverty in the world today, and I was talking about poverty, and Bill Gates is running around distributing his money to the poor people. Hell, that's that's like pissing in the wind on a windy day. You're not going anywhere doing that. The way to make people wealthy is to give people control of the natural resources and let them go to work. Wealth is produced by work. And so what we have here in this country, we have a class of people called welfarers. And 51% of the people in America are on welfare. 51% are receiving some form of government check. And when you eliminate that, you know, you go back 100 years, we didn't have that 100 years ago. And when you eliminate that welfare, then you increase work. And the concept of unemployment is a misnomer. There's no such thing as unemployment. That's a politically contrived misnomer. Unemployment says all of the work has been done. I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, all of the work on planet Earth has not been done, past tense. There's lots of work out there to do. And by working on the natural resources in the ground, because all wealth comes out of the ground, all this coal comes out of the ground, all this coal is owned by a few strong hands. All of this coal needs to be divided up and owned by millions of little hands. I mentioned this the other day. In Humboldt County, California, when I was a kid, there were 237 sawmills. 237 people, 237 families produced all the lumber in that county. 237 sawmills. Today, there's 5. Louisiana Pacific and Georgia Pacific and Weyerhaeuser and, you know, these big multinational corporations own all the timber. And they produce all of the lumber. And all of the people there work for these big corporations. Well, that's what you people said you wanted, you know. President Bush said what Americans want are jobs, jobs, jobs. You don't want to own a sawmill. You don't want to have employees. You people don't want wealth. You couldn't handle it if it was given to you. What you want are jobs. You want to work for the man. You want employment. You want security. You want to practice the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. You absolutely loathe the 10 commandments. Well, okay, there's an outcome that comes from that. There's a result that results from that. And so that's what we have. But getting back here to liquefaction now, coals can also be converted into liquid fuels like gasoline or diesel by several different processes. The Fischer-Tropsch process, that's spelled T-R-O-P-S-C-H, Fischer, and it's spelled F-I-S-C-H-E-R, it's a German name. It's the Fischer-Tropsch process of indirect synthesis of liquid hydrocarbons was used in Nazi Germany for many years and is today used by Sasol in South Africa. Coal would be gasified to make syngas, a balanced purified mixture of CO and H2 gas, and the syngas condensed using Fischer-Tropsch catalysts to make light hydrocarbons, which are further processed into gasoline and diesel. Syngas can also be converted to methanol, which can be used as a fuel or as a fuel additive or further processed into gasoline by way of the mobile M-gas process. A direct liquefaction process called the Burgess process, liquefaction by hydrogeneration, is also available but was not or has not been used outside of Germany, where such processes were operated both during World War I and World War II. Sasol, S-A-S-O-L, in South Africa, has experimented with direct hydrogeneration. Several other direct liquefaction processes have been developed, among these being the SRC1 and SRC2, that's the solvent refined coal process developed by Gulf Oil and implemented as pilot plants in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. Another direct hydrogeneration process was explored by the NUS Corporation in 1976 and patented by William C. Schroeder. The process involved dried pulverized coal mixed with roughly 1% by weight molybdenum catalysts. Hydrogenation occurred by the use of high temperature and pressure synthesis and gas produced in a separate gasifier. The process ultimately yielded a synthetic crude product, naphtha, a limited amount of C3-C4 gas, light medium weight liquid, C5-C10, suitable for use as fuels, small amounts of NH3 and significant amounts of CO2. Yet another process to manufacture liquid hydrocarbons from coal is low-temperature carbonization, called the LTC process. Coal is cooked or coked at temperatures between 450 and 700 degrees centigrade compared to 800 to 1,000 degrees centigrade for metallurgical coke. These temperatures optimize the production of coal tars, richer in lighter hydrocarbons than normal coal tar. The coal tar is then further processed into fuels. The Carrick process was developed by Lewis C. Carrick, an oil shale technologist at the U.S. Bureau of Mines back in the 1920s. Now, this oil shale, remember, here in the United States, we've got 3.6 trillion barrels of that stuff sitting right here in the good old U.S. of A. And the technique for gasification and turning that oil shale into oil was discovered back in the 1920s. The technology's been around forever. Now, all of these liquid fuel production methods release carbon dioxide in the conversion process, far more than is released in the extraction and refinement of liquid fuel production from petroleum. Now, if these methods were adopted to replace declining petroleum supplies, carbon dioxide emissions would be greatly increased on a global scale. For future liquefaction projects, carbon dioxide sequestration is proposed to avoid releasing it into the atmosphere, though no pilot projects have confirmed the feasibility of this approach on a
wide scale. As CO2 is one of the processed streams, sequestration is easier than from flue gases produced in combustion of coal with air, where CO2 is diluted by nitrogen and other gases. Sequestration will, however, add to the cost. Now, coal liquefaction is one of the backstop technologies that could potentially limit escalation of oil prices and mitigate the effects of transportation, energy shortage, and some authors have suggested could occur under peak oil. This is contingent on liquefaction production capacity becoming large enough to satiate the very large and growing demand for petroleum. Now, estimates of the cost of producing liquid fuels from coal suggest that domestic U.S. production of fuel from coal becomes cost competitive, with oil priced at around $35 a barrel. Now, you'll notice that you've got oil coming in at $100 a barrel. We could make it out of coal for $35 a barrel, so why aren't we? Well, because you have this top-down energy policy. You have this communist program. It's mandated by the president. It was orchestrated by Dick Cheney. Remember when they first took office, the Republicans, back in 2001. They got together with all the big oil companies and said, here's our energy policy. That's the way Joe Stalin did it, you know, from the top down in Russia. Now, just keeping in mind, $35 a barrel is the break-even price. This price, while above historic averages, is well below current oil prices. This makes coal a viable financial alternative to oil for the time being, although current production is small. Among commercially mature technologies, advantage for indirect coal liquefaction over direct coal liquefaction are reported by William and Larson in 2003, and the estimates are reported for sites in China where break-even cost for coal liquefaction may be in the range of $25 to $35 a barrel. Boys and girls, if we had fuel at $25 a barrel, $30 a barrel, double it to $60, we would have $2 a gallon gas. We're on our way to $6 a gallon gas with a $1 a gallon carbon tax. And that's where we're headed. That's what the agenda calls for. Get ready for it, because that's what's going to happen. You can bet on it. That being the case, then we need to make our plans going, you and I, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, down here at the bottom of the pile. You and I need to make our plans for the future, just like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers are making their plans. I mean, you know, they're in control, they're making their plans, and here's what we're going to do. So little guys like us need to make our plans also. Keep in mind, we teach a business school here at the law school, and the business school is predicated upon the Ten Commandments, of all things. Yeah, the Ten Commandments. It's the most cost-effective, profit-oriented system ever created by the mind of God. The Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Remember our business school. Hey, we're about out of time here, children. Now that we've exhausted coal, we'll be back talking about energy next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And that's what you've been listening to here. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.